Open marriage is not an epidemic. But again, that misses an important point. The way we talk about marriage has changed profoundly since the 1960s, and that by itself has profound consequences. Marriage as an institution depends upon how the society around it talks about it. The rhetoric around marriage affects its desirability for both men and women. When the sophisticated opinion is, who needs it, there are real consequences, both in law, but also in the far more important climate of expectations people have about how to live a fulfilling life. When the mainline Protestant churches caved in to the bourgeois cultural populism of the me decade by removing or loosening many of the stigmas, rules, and customs that attach to divorce, they were downgrading the status of marriage. Prior to the late 1960s, writes the University of Virginia's Brad Wilcox, one of America's leading marriage researchers and an AEI colleague of mine, Americans were more likely to look at marriage and family through the prisms of duty, obligation, and sacrifice. A successful, happy home was one in which intimacy was an important good, but by no means the only one in view. A decent job, a well-maintained home, mutual spousal aid, child-rearing, and shared religious faith were seen almost universally as the goods that marriage and family life were intended to advance. This is what Wilcox calls the institutional model of marriage. Sex was reserved, according to the ideal at least, for marriage. Certainly marriage was the only legitimate or at least desirable model for having children. In short, the old attitude was that one must work for the marriage. The new attitude was that the marriage had better work for me. In 1962, roughly half of American women agreed with the statement, when there are children in the family, parents should stay together even if they don't get along. By 1977, only one in five American women agreed. Where the culture goes, so goes the state. Ronald Reagan signed the first no-fault divorce law as governor of California in 1969. As so often happens, where California leads, much of the nation follows. In the decade and a half that followed, virtually every state in the union followed California's lead and enacted a no-fault divorce law of its own. This legal transformation was only one of the more visible signs of the divorce revolution then sweeping the United States. From 1960 to 1980, the divorce rate more than doubled, from 9.2 divorces per 1,000 married women to 22.6 divorces per 1,000 married women. This meant that while less than 20% of couples who married in 1950 ended up divorced, about 50% of couples who married in 1970 did. And approximately half of the children born to married parents in the 1970s saw their parents part, compared to only about 11% of those born in the 1950s. No-fault divorce was just one way in which the state accelerated the cultural trend. Under the Great Society, with an overabundance of good intentions, the federal government started subsidizing women who had children out of wedlock. For instance, a program, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, originally intended to provide modest pensions for the widows of coal miners, became a broad entitlement for single mothers paid out on a per-baby basis. The problem is that the way the program was structured, the funds were cut off if the recipient got married, thus penalizing mothers for seeking a more stable family. Welfare reform in 1996 fixed some of these problems, but it didn't eliminate them. According to a study by C. Eugene Sterley of the Urban Institute, a single mother working full-time at a minimum wage job who marries a man also working full-time at the same wage would lose $8,060 in cash and non-cash welfare benefits. Trying to pinpoint single causes for the profound transformation in attitudes and practices around marriage is pointless. This is a big, diverse society, and big diverse phenomena have big diverse causes. Still, the statistics speak for themselves. Roughly 7 out of 10 black children are born out of wedlock. The out-of-wedlock birth rate for whites, 29%, is now higher than it was for blacks, 24%, when Daniel Patrick Moynihan issued his famous, or infamous, 1965 report, The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. Since 1974, roughly 1 million children per year have experienced the dissolution of their family, and these children are 2 to 3 times more likely than their peers in intact marriages to suffer from serious social or psychological pathologies. Now, it must be acknowledged that the transformation of ideas about marriage had some benefits. This is not all a tale of woe. Whatever complaints you might have about various forms of doctrinaire or radical feminism, the core gains from the women's rights movement are not ones even most social conservatives would be comfortable rolling back, starting, of course, with women's suffrage, but also the broader acceptance that women have an equal right to men to pursue happiness. I certainly wouldn't want to go back to a world where women's occupational choices were limited to a few women's jobs, like teaching, retail sales, nursing, and working at telephone switchboards. As the son and husband of successful career women, already a kind of antiquated term, and the father of a teenage girl whom I expect to follow in their footsteps, I welcome many of these changes. Nor would I like to see anyone trapped in an unworkable marriage. In other words, we can acknowledge that important progress has been made, but we should also recognize that the implosion of the institutional model of marriage has had profound consequences for society, especially children. No matter how impressive a single mother or a single father may be, the simple fact remains that as a generalization, two parents are better than one. Such statements are upsetting to many Americans who believe to say such a thing unfairly stigmatizes single parents and the children of single parents. One can sympathize with the desire not to make an already formidable burden even heavier. But facts do not care about feelings, which is why we are in the midst of a war on facts on all sides these days. A recent study by Princeton University and the left-of-center Brookings Institution reported that most scholars now agree that children raised by two biological parents in a stable marriage do better than children in other family forms across a wide range of outcomes. Sociologists Sarah McClanahan and Gary Sandifer determined that adolescent children of divorced parents were almost 3 times more likely to drop out of high school, 31% to 13% for children of intact families. They also found that a third of adolescent girls with divorced parents became teen mothers, whereas 11% of girls from married parents became teen mothers. More than 1 in 10 male children of divorce, 11%, spent some time in prison before the age of 32. Only 5% of boys from intact homes were ever incarcerated. It is a cruel fact of human nature that evolution makes us biased towards our own kin in ways the rational mind cannot always accept or explain. Andrew J. Cherlin reports that even remarriage isn't the solution many of us hope it will be. In the marriage go-round, The State of Marriage and the Family in America Today, Cherlin recounts that children whose parents have remarried do not have higher levels of well-being than children in lone parent families. Cherlin attributes this to the stresses associated with moving and bonding or not bonding with step-parents and siblings. No doubt that's part of it, but there are surely deeply rooted biological factors at play as well. A parent's patience will tend to run out with stepchildren more quickly than with biological children, notes Steven Pinker. And in extreme cases, this can lead to abuse. A dismaying study by Nicholas Zill of the Institute for Family Studies found that adopted children have a harder time at school than kids raised by their biological parents. What makes this so dismaying is that adoptive parents tend to be better off financially and are just as willing as traditional parents, if not more so, to put in the time and effort of raising kids. Zill's finding highlights the problem with traditional family triumphalism. Adoption is a wonderful thing, and just because there are challenges that come with adoption, no one would ever argue that the problems adopted kids face make the alternatives to adoption better. Kids left in orphanages or trapped in abusive homes do even worse. Similarly, the well-established finding that parents of non-biological children often struggle with non-biological offspring doesn't mean that people with children should not remarry. What is required in such marriages is extra effort to compensate for the inevitable pull of human nature. Obviously, I believe this is much more than an argument about economics. But looking at the family through an economic lens helps us see the real-world consequences in ways table-pounding rhetoric and nostalgic nostrums about the way things used to be cannot. Consider the stress so many families go through when elderly parents can no longer care for themselves. The pressures involved can hardly be captured solely by economic considerations. The feelings of obligation adult children have towards their parents and to their own children cannot be easily or fully translated into financial terms, but they can be illuminated by them. A Rand Corporation study found that elderly people with no children end up paying far more over their remaining lifetime for nursing home care. Why? Because they spend more time in nursing homes. People with children, particularly daughters, spend less because the kids make a nursing home less necessary. The data are silent on the emotional significance, but it's not hard to fill in the blanks. How we take care of the elderly is an important issue, but how we raise children matters more for the future of the country. The Brookings Institution's Isabel Sawhill, no Bible-thumping right-winger, has found that 20% of the increase in child poverty since 1970 can be attributed to family breakdown. A study by Brad Wilcox found that states with more married parents do better on a broad range of economic indicators, including upward mobility for poor children and lower rates of child poverty. On most economic indicators, the Washington Post summarized, the share of parents who are married in a state is a better predictor of that state's economic health than the racial composition and educational attainment of that state's residents. Also left out of the conversation is the incredible economic benefit marriage has for men. Married men, controlling for all factors, make 44% more than single men. Pascal Emmanuel Gobry notes that the wage benefit for marriage is roughly equal to, if not greater than, that of going to college. But, he adds, economists are quick to extol the vital importance of going to college, but are loath to emphasize or even talk about the benefits of marriage. Ron Haskins, also of the Brookings Institution, has identified what he calls the success sequence. At least finish high school, get a full-time job, and wait until age 21 to get married and have children. If young people do just these three things in that order, they are almost guaranteed to climb out of poverty. Our research shows that of American adults who followed these three simple rules, only about 2% are in poverty, and nearly 75% have joined the middle class, defined as earning around $55,000 or more per year. Undoubtedly, some teenagers could be persuaded to follow these steps with appeals to cool reason. But is it really so ridiculous to claim that society as a whole would have an easier time persuading more kids to follow this sequence if they were in families that modeled this practice themselves? Or if celebrities and other elites openly promoted these lifestyles? Or if they put a smidgen of stigma on out-of-wedlock births and baby daddy culture? Indeed, this highlights the profound failure and hypocrisy of elites in our culture. Amidst all the talk of marriage's decline, an important trend often gets overlooked. Marriage among elites is doing okay. The divorce rate among affluent Americans stabilized in the late 1980s and has largely recovered, at least among whites. The share of young white women with college degrees who were married in 2010 was just over 70%. That's pretty much where it was in 1950. Less than 9% of college-educated white women had an unwed birth in 2011, very close to the number for women in 1950. A Pew Research Center analysis of the most recent U.S. Census Bureau data found that marriage is more correlated with socioeconomic status than at any time in our history. College-educated Americans tend to get a degree, get married, and have children in that order. Meanwhile, marriage, particularly among the working class, has gone out of style. Charles Murray's Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010, exhaustively documents these trends. Not surprisingly, college-educated professionals tend to marry other college-educated professionals, widening the rift between elites and everyone else. It is the privileged Americans who are marrying, and marrying helps them stay privileged, Andrew J. Cherlin, a sociologist at Johns Hopkins University, told the New York Times. Up to 40% of the growth in economic inequality may be attributable to changes in the pattern of marriage in the United States. The people with more education tend to have stable family structure with committed, involved fathers, Princeton sociologist Sarah McClanahan added. The people with less education are more likely to have complex, unstable situations involving men who come and go. Wilcox attributes these trends to the degradation of the institutional model of marriage and to the subsequent ascendancy of the soulmate model. The romantic ideal of finding a soulmate has deep historical roots, but for most of human history, marriage was a political, religious, and economic institution largely removed from notions of true love and soulmates. That started to change not long after the economic miracle of the Lockean Revolution. Soulmate marriage is not a uniquely American ideal, but it has been most intensely idealized and democratized in America, and this ideal is arguably America's greatest cultural export, though marriage for love is still not the norm in many parts of the non-Western world. The big change in recent years is the one Brad Wilcox identified. Finding a true life partner was always an important consideration, but it was not the sole consideration. It was always nice in an arranged marriage when the youngsters found each other agreeable, but it was hardly the only item on the checklist. Even after arranged marriages ceased to be an acceptable norm, the checklist approach endured. Women and their parents still defined a good match beyond the narrow calculation of finding the one. Would the man be a good provider? Would the woman be a good mother? Did he or she come from a good family, practice the right faith, and so on? A few generations ago, marrying purely for love was a luxury largely reserved for the affluent. We are in some respects returning to that model, the difference being that in the past, the poor still got married. Not so much anymore. Today, the soulmate model works on the self-centered, though not necessarily selfish, view that there is a single person out there who will allow me to be the person I want to be. This pursuit of happiness, newly defined, has much to recommend it, particularly for women. I certainly wouldn't want to go back to the time when the choice of whom to marry didn't reside entirely with the couple involved, except in the case of my daughter, where I would like veto power. The problem isn't that men and women have the right to choose their own life partners. It is that culturally, the range of factors taken into account for that choice has narrowed. And that has drawbacks. For starters, it is more likely to lead to divorce. If marriage is all about romantic notions of personal fulfillment, there is precious little left to fall back on when marriage isn't all you hoped it would be. By telling poor people, especially, that they must hold out for the one, society is, if not closing, then at least narrowing access to the best institution for raising children, getting and staying out of poverty, and finding meaning beyond purely individualistic terms. It is remarkable that, in all of the hand-wringing about the rise in economic inequality, the issue of marriage's dissolution almost never makes an appearance in the debate. Family lays all the crucial groundwork for the kind of person you will become. When I say that family is the gateway to civilization, I mean that literally. The family civilizes barbarians. It imprints them with language, customs, mores, values, and expectations for how society should work. If culture is a conversation, then the family is where all conversation begins. To be sure, other institutions pick up and round out the work of the family. Some researchers claim that peers have more influence on kids than parents do. Maybe. But parents have a huge role in who those peers will be. From where they live, to where they send their kids to school, to what hobbies they pursue and associations they form. Still, as nearly every teacher in the world will tell you, the first and most important work starts in the home. In 2012, Washington Post columnist Cortland Malloy asked a good question. Why is African American participation in professional baseball at an all-time low? Economics doesn't offer much insight. Baseball offers the highest return for professional athletes of any sport. But culture plays a big role, albeit one that is hard to quantify. Basketball and football are more popular and glamorous. Baseball is a slower sport, less amenable to television coverage. Public policy plays some role as well. Local governments find baseball diamonds an expensive line item. But one partial answer jumped out. Fathers. If you did a survey, I believe you'd find that the one thing average and above average players have in common is a father. Gerald Hall Jr., the baseball director for a local youth league, told Malloy. Baseball is, at heart, a father and son sport. And if you are a kid that has nobody to throw to, nobody to talk to, nobody to discipline you in the way that baseball demands, you're not likely to play the game. Tony Davenport, a local coach, agreed. You have to catch the kids early. Start with the basics. How to hold a bat. The proper throwing motion. Catch with the glove, not your hand, he said. A lot of kids really enjoy it if they continue to be provided with guidance. Basketball is a sport that's largely picked up from peers. So is football. But baseball is arcane. It requires explanation and patience. You don't have to subscribe to all the sentimental arguments about the importance of fathers to appreciate how an absent father creates difficulties. A simple division of labor suggests that it's hard for a single parent to both prepare or provide dinner or work two jobs and play catch with a kid or sit on a couch for a few hours watching and explaining a game at the same time. But here's the important part. This observation is true not just for baseball, but for an entire suite of life lessons, skills, and tasks, from playing a musical instrument to learning a trade to understanding good habits. Single parents, either never married or divorced, simply have less time to dedicate to parenting than they otherwise might. This has numerous knock-on effects. Struggling single parents are more likely to let the TV, iPad, or Xbox serve as a babysitter. They take less time vetting peers who might seduce their kids into bad habits. They model behaviors, like serial dating, or understandably, short tempers that may not always be ideal. Of course, the world is full of counterexamples of successful people raised by single parents. In many of these cases, grandparents or other members of the extended family stepped in. In others, the mother did it all. Some mothers can do it all. but that is a lot to ask of them, and not the best way to organize a society. It all boils down to conversation, gratitude, and remembering. People tend to value what societies celebrate. The broader conversation about marriage, family, and parenthood has decayed. It is in better shape than it was in the days when Betty Friedan could liken housewives to concentration camp victims and fringe radicals were shouting, "Smash monogamy!" Serious people don't say, "A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle," anymore. But the rhetoric about marriage and parenting is shot through with culture war politics on the right and identity politics victimology on the left. In the mushy middle, it's usually adorned with self-help nostrums and silly verbiage about do-it-yourself life hacks. Gay marriage notwithstanding, among the cosmopolitans at the commanding heights of our culture, it is simply D-class A to extol the benefits of the bourgeois married lifestyle, at least in a public forum. Meanwhile, intellectuals and activists hector and demonize anyone who bestows undue honor on marriage, or, more often, scorn or stigma on promiscuity, divorce, or out-of-wedlock birth. Dan Quayle, who as vice president criticized the TV show Murphy Brown for celebrating out-of-wedlock birth, was vilified by cultural elites for his prudishness and Comstockery. But, as a matter of public policy, he was right. Those who would prefer to, at best, ignore the role of culture in the degradation of the family emphasize purely material explanations for the decomposition. The family, they say, has come apart because of the disappearance of the family wage, which was held aloft by large levels of unionization. And while it would be foolish to argue that the structure of the economy plays no role in encouraging or discouraging people to form families, such claims are overblown. The materialists aren't wrong that economic conditions are important. Their error is in assuming that economic explanations tell the whole story. The sacrifices inherent to parenthood require an enormous amount of social support to remain attractive, particularly in an age when there are so many enjoyable distractions made possible by the mass affluence of capitalism. Joseph Schumpeter recognized that the family was the one indispensable institution to liberal democratic capitalism. The sacrifices it demands of parents, he said, do not consist only of the items that come within the reach of the measuring rod of money. They demand more intangible things like time, emotional commitment, and the subordination of our wants and desires to the needs of our children. These sacrifices need to be honored publicly and passionately. At the beginning of this chapter, I suggested that the plight of the family traces the larger argument of this book in miniature. In case I did a poor job of showing that, let me magnify the point. It is my argument that capitalism and liberal democracy are unnatural. We stumbled into them in a process of trial and error, but also blind luck, contingency, and happenstance, a blink of an eye ago. The market system depends on bourgeois values, i.e. principles, ideas, habits, and sentiments that it did not create and cannot restore once lost. These values can only be transmitted two ways, showing and telling. That is to say, by modeling right behaviors and instructing people through words and images what right behavior looks like. Institutions, not the government, are the chief mechanisms for communicating and rewarding these values. Moreover, modernity itself requires that citizens have divided and diverse loyalties. One of these is loyalty to self. We all have a right to pursue happiness as we see it. But others include loyalty to family, friends, faith, community, work, etc. Our problems today can be traced to the fact that we no longer have gratitude for the miracle and for the institutions and customs that made it possible. Where there is no gratitude and the effort that gratitude demands, all manner of resentments and hostilities flood back in. Few actually hate the traditional nuclear family or the role it plays, but many are indifferent to it. And indifference alone is enough to invite the rust of human nature back in. Hannah Arendt once observed that in every generation, Western civilization is invaded by barbarians. We call them children. The family is the first line of defense against this barbarian invasion. The metaphor is inapt because parents aren't at war with babies themselves. But parents are at war with the darker side of human nature, which we all work to trim away from our children by inscribing in their hearts notions of decency, fair play, and self-restraint. When parents fail to do that, other institutions, including the government, try to step in and remedy what they can. But no teacher, counselor, social service worker, priest, rabbi, imam, or police officer will deny that when the family fails to do its part, the work of every institution downstream of the family becomes that much more difficult. This doesn't mean that every failed family produces criminals, never mind marauding barbarians. But when the family fails, it becomes harder to produce good citizens dedicated to the principles and habits that created the miracle in the first place. 13. The Trumpian Era, The Perils of Populism. Let's pick up where we left off in the last chapter. Civilization is an ongoing conversation. Change the conversation, you change the world. If a baby born today is no different from a baby born 50,000 years ago, then the only thing keeping that baby from growing up into a barbarian is the conversation he or she is born into. This is the moral of everything we have discussed so far. Deirdre McCloskey says the miracle happened because of words and talk. The economy is nothing without the words supporting it, she insists. Capitalism, like democracy, is talk, 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 all the way down. This is true about more than just the economy. It is true about politics, family, religion, and every human endeavor. We are a cooperative species, and it was our ability to communicate concepts that sent us skyrocketing up the food chain. One need not be too literal here. It's not, strictly speaking, the words themselves, but how we use them, the concepts they form and convey. But it is axiomatically true that what can be created by conversation can be destroyed by conversation. A holiday dinner can be a lovely affair or a dark and dismal disaster, all depending on the course of the conversation. So it is with our civilization. The Glorious Revolution and the American Revolution represented the ascendance of a new bourgeois worldview that elevated liberty, commerce, innovation, hard work, and the autonomy of family and individual alike. This worldview bubbled up from below far more than it trickled down from above. The bourgeoisie asserted their rights, and once they were won, those rights steadily became more and more universal because that was the only way the conversation could go. Once you say that all men are created equal and that we are endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it becomes ever more difficult to say, well, except for those people. Once you insist that the only legitimate form of government is government by consent of the people, it's very difficult to walk that back. Indeed, until fairly recently, dictators and totalitarians had to claim the mantle of democracy, talking as if it were something even they had to believe in, if they wanted to be seen as legitimate rulers. The Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, Mussolini's Italy, they all insisted that they spoke for the people's will, even if they rejected the mechanical fictions of Western politics and held Potemkin elections. East Germany called itself the German Democratic Republic. North Korea still goes by the name Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Syria's Bashar al-Assad and the mullahs in Iran feel the need to hold elections and referenda for the sake of appearances, just like Saddam Hussein, Hosni Mubarak, and Napoleon before them. Even the deceit of dictators was a tribute paid to democracy's virtue. In the West, the left and the right argued about how and where to draw the line between social welfare and economic liberty. But the rest of the conversation usually boiled down to which party was more committed to democracy, free speech, and personal liberty. Progressives from FDR to Barack Obama believed that granting economic rights would liberate people. Recall that FDR proclaimed that necessitous men are not free men. Conservatives in the classical liberal tradition argued that this approach was a violation of liberalism, properly understood, and was destined to constrict freedom in the end. These disagreements were and remain intense. But if you took each side at its word, both believed they were on the side of liberty and each used rhetoric to that effect. That started to change in the early part of the 21st century. For the last two decades, the rhetoric of Western elites has grown increasingly hostile to democracy, free speech, and capitalism. One reason is the widespread belief that authoritarian societies develop faster and better than democratic and free market ones. This is a very old notion that emerges in new wrappings every generation. Mussolini made the trains run on time. Lincoln Steffens returned from the Soviet Union to declare, "I have been over to the future, and it works." They said it about Napoleon's command economy, and they probably said it about Hammurabi's too. There's just something deeply seductive about the idea of society being run by a strong father figure or some wise council of experts. This is particularly true among the class of people who believe they should be on just such a council. They cast their gaze abroad and look for examples of societies doing things the right way, and then insist we should be following that example. That's what countless intellectuals in America said in the 1920s and early 1930s about fascist and communist regimes in Europe. And, like a dog returning to its vomit, they do so today. William Easterly, one of the most brilliant scholars of development economics alive today, documents how this cult of authoritarianism thrives among the global cast of development experts and the journalists who rely on them. Part of the problem of looking to so-called successful autocracies as models is that it is something of a statistical mirage. It's true that in the last 50 years, 9 out of 10 of the countries with truly extraordinary economic growth have been autocracies. This suggests that autocracy offers the best path to prosperity. The problem is that, over that period, there were 89 autocracies. In other words, being an autocracy under the best of circumstances offers perhaps a 1 in 9 chance of leading to prosperity. But even this is misleading because the policies implemented by the successful autocracies tend to move countries away from despotism. Lee Kuan Yew, the founding dictator of Singapore, is the global elite's favorite benign despot, and for good reason. His policies did lead to amazing economic growth. But how did he do that? By wrenching out the corruption, both in the conventional sense and in the way I've been using it, from Singaporean society. He was an at times brutal modernizer. In the 1990s, Singapore had one of the highest per capita execution rates in the world. Under the Singapore model, graft and other forms of bribery are ruthlessly prescribed, and the rule of law, including property rights and contract enforcement under British common law, is just as ruthlessly protected. Lee Kuan Yew believed in low regulation, low taxation, and free trade. In other words, the crucial ingredient for Singapore's growth wasn't despotism, but the imposition of market mechanisms and, to some extent, the legacy of British colonialism. Lee Kuan Yew's success, no doubt, depended in part on his ability to not be corrupted by power and keep the country on a path to modernization, and I would wager, eventual democratization. But it also stemmed from the unique nature of Singapore itself, a small island nation. But for every Lee Kuan Yew, there are many more Hugo Chavez's, Fidel Castro's, and Robert Mugabe's. Betting on authoritarian states on the assumption that you will get a Lee Kuan Yew is playing a lottery with millions of lives. The more important point, however, is that fawning on dictatorships is morally grotesque. It is ultimately just a form of power worship. For instance, New York Times columnist and best-selling author Thomas Friedman has spent much of the last two decades gushing over China's enlightened authoritarian capitalism. "Look to China," he insisted in column after column, speech after speech, and book after book. "They only care about optimal policies." Well, okay, let's look to China. Authoritarianism, under the emperors and then under Mao, immiserated, oppressed, or murdered hundreds of millions of people in China. Then, in the late 1970s, China introduced rudimentary markets and property rights. And suddenly, the Chinese economy took off. For the first time, hundreds of millions of Chinese people could eat meat, enjoy electricity, and acquire other things long considered staples here and unattainable luxuries there. Yet here in America and around much of the developed world, the reaction to China's success was, "Wow, it must have been the authoritarianism." Friedman was, in many respects, the head cheerleader. He writes, "Watching both the healthcare and climate energy debates in Congress, it is hard not to draw the following conclusion. There is only one thing worse than one-party autocracy, and that is one-party democracy, which is what we have in America today. One-party autocracy certainly has its drawbacks, but when it is led by a reasonably enlightened group of people as China is today, it can also have great advantages. That one party can just impose the politically difficult but critically important policies needed to move a society forward in the 21st century." It's worth explaining what Friedman means by one-party democracy. At the time he wrote this, the Democratic Party controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House. But the party in the one-party democracy, Friedman lamented, was not the ruling party, but the minority party, because it refused to capitulate to the majority. The benefit of autocracy is that it is autocratic and can dispense with persuasion and impose the best policies. In his book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America, Friedman has a chapter titled, China for a Day, but Not for Two. In it, he openly pines for America to be like China, but just for a day. On this day, there would be no rule of law, no constitutional safeguards, and no democratic debate. Instead, enlightened experts would simply be able to impose the best policies, i.e., the policies Friedman agrees with. This is a perfect example of how words can camouflage things. His columns are full of the sorts of buzz phrases and jargon that fill the air at Davos meetings and TED Talks. But what does China for a day mean that is substantially different from king for a day, or tyranny for a day, or for that matter, Nazis for a day? Saying China for a day gives the argument a certain cachet, but that cachet is just a different label on the same ancient bottle. Also, if there is any lesson worth taking to heart from the last 1,000 or 10,000 years, is that if you give people absolute power just for a day, expect them to find reasons to give themselves an extension. Absolute power is like being granted a wish by a genie. The first thing you do is wish for more wishes. Ultimately, wanting to be China for a day is no different from talking about how our politics should be like the moral equivalent of war. Another argument Friedman employs constantly, saying that we must fight climate change the way we fought World War II. Green, he explains, is the new red, white, and blue. We are hardwired to dispense with pleasantries and protocol when under attack. The technocrats understand this, which is why the Obama administration loved the phrase, A crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And it is why the Trump campaign was, and the Trump White House is, so eager to describe America as a violence-plagued hellscape when it serves their political agenda. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now, the president declared in his inaugural address, which he concluded with an upraised fist. How we talk is merely a reflection of what we think. No wonder, then, that the state of public opinion in the West is depressing. A majority of young people no longer believe democracy is essential. Support for liberty is literally dying out. Among those born in the 1930s, 75% of Americans and 53% of Europeans say living under democratic government is essential. Among people born in the 1980s, the number drops to the low 40s in Europe and the low 30s in America. Only 32% of millennials consider it absolutely essential that civil rights protect people's liberty. Citizens in a number of supposedly consolidated democracies in North America and Western Europe have not only grown more critical of their political leaders, write political scientists Roberto Stefan Foa and Yasha Monk in the Journal of Democracy. Rather, they have also become more cynical about the value of democracy as a political system, less hopeful that anything they do might influence public policy, and more willing to express support for authoritarian alternatives. There is ample evidence that support for the core rights that define a liberal order is eroding, most precipitously among young people, though it is possible that, as a reaction to the Trump presidency, some young people might develop a heightened appreciation for civil liberties. The younger you are, the less likely you are to support free speech rights. 40% of 18 to 34-year-olds told Pew they thought that speech offensive to minorities should be banned. A survey of college students in 2015 found that a majority of students favor speech codes for both students and faculty. More than 6 in 10 want professors to provide students with trigger warnings before discussing or presenting material some might find offensive. A third of the students couldn't name the First Amendment as the part of the Constitution that protects free speech. 35% said the First Amendment doesn't apply to hate speech. It does. And 30% of self-identified liberal students said they believe the First Amendment is outdated. Presumably, most young liberals do not think support for free markets, democracy, and free speech is itself hate speech. But it is remarkable how quickly activists can conclude that support for such things are code words for hateful ideals. The Harvard Crimson has a long history of running articles insisting that the eminent scholar Harvey Mansfield, one of the last conservatives at Harvard, is a practitioner of hate speech. Duke historian Nancy McLean published a book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, in which she argues that the libertarian economics movement, specifically the public choice school, is a thinly concealed racist scheme designed to undermine democracy. Despite the fact the book was torn to shreds for dishonest and shabby scholarship, a work of speculative historical fiction, according to McLean's Duke colleague, Michael Munger, it was, as of this writing, a finalist for the National Book Award. Apparently, the thesis is too seductive to care about the facts. Just try to talk about individualism, inequality, merit, etc. on a college campus and see how long it takes before someone is offended. In many places where the new class controls the commanding heights of the culture, free speech has come to be defined as assault, and assault as free speech. Before the Obama administration's deception about a video causing the attacks on the American diplomatic compound in Benghazi was debunked, liberal op-ed pages and radio and TV shows lit up with calls to fix the First Amendment and curtail free speech in America, as if rioting barbarians halfway around the world have a heckler's veto on what Americans say. It is inevitable that when the way people think and talk changes, the shape of our politics will change too. Across Europe, illiberal movements have been gaining steam for more than a decade. Marine Le Pen's National Front has the wind at its back, forcing artificial coalitions between traditional conservatives and socialists to keep it out of power. Emmanuel Macron succeeded in defeating Le Pen, but he needed to form a new party to do it, La République En Marche, or simply En Marche, which in English is translated variously as forward or onward or working or on the move. As of this writing, it is too soon to form a lasting judgment on Macron, but it appears that he has something of a Napoleonic streak to him. He pledges to go around the French Parliament and impose most of his reforms by decree. He has already extended the state of emergency declared in the wake of some horrific terrorist attacks in 2015. In Austria, a coalition similar to Macron's narrowly prevented Norbert Hofer from becoming the first right-wing nationalist leader of a Western European country since the end of World War II. In neighboring Hungary, President Viktor Orban routinely talks of building an illiberal new national state, modeled after the regimes in Russia, Turkey, and China. Liberal democratic states can't remain globally competitive, he insists. Orban's biggest political competition is Jobbik, an ultra-nationalist party that is economically left-wing and anti-capitalist and feeds off a deep reserve of anti-Semitism in the country. An estimated 1 in 5 Hungarians have extreme animosity towards Jews. In Bulgaria, the nationalist socialist party ATAK, has made huge strides blending a populist anti-immigrant agenda with conventional economic and racial socialism, which again are more often than not synonymous historically. In Greece, a hard-left nationalist party, Syriza, dominates while the authoritarian right-wing party, Golden Dawn, is a close third. Golden Dawn marches under a banner conveniently reminiscent of the official Nazi flag, displaying a black meander against a backdrop of red. The party's lodestar is the Greek pro-fascist dictator Ioannis Metaxas, who ruled from 1936 to 1941. In Britain, the triumph of the Brexit movement, while salutary on the whole, arguably owed its relatively narrow margin of victory to an undercurrent of nativist and nationalist sentiment, fomented to some extent by Vladimir Putin's social media troll army. More troubling is the illiberalism of Jeremy Corbyn, the unreconstructed leftist who leads the Labour Party and rejects Tony Blair's project to reconcile the party with liberal democratic capitalism. A left-wing populist and fervent opponent of all things Zionist, Corbyn struggles to avoid the charge of anti-Semitism while pandering to members of his coalition who cannot avoid the charge. Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in just a few short years, has gone a long way to meld the illiberal politics of Ataturk with the illiberal theology of the Ottomans, persecuting journalists and imprisoning political opponents by the thousands. As of this writing, Venezuela under Nicolas Maduro continues to prove that things can always get worse under a populist socialist dictatorship. The oil-rich basket case is now in the throes of Weimar-level hyperinflation. Parents are forced to give away their children because they cannot feed them, as Maduro blames the country's economic woes on the bourgeois parasites. In July of 2017, President Trump visited Warsaw, Poland, and gave a stirring defense of Western civilization, much of which I agreed with. But the speech had an overlay of nationalism to it that did not go unnoticed by the increasingly authoritarian Polish government. The ruling party, Law and Justice, is committed to a campaign of delegitimizing the press, the independent judiciary, and even the apolitical nature of the military under a program called Repolonization. Tragically, the dream of liberalism is dying away in illiberal countries as well. The green movement in Iran has been crushed from above, but has also withered from below. The educated young who were the backbone of the green movement are now demoralized and apathetic 30- and 40-somethings, a transformation not unlike what happened to China's pro-democracy movement after the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, writes Sohrab Ahmari. The situation is equally grim in the Arab lands, he adds. Save for Tunisia, the Arab Spring uprisings of 2010 and 2011 have everywhere yielded civil war, state failure, or a return to the repressive status quo ante. Public opinion surveys suggest that the region's young aspire to stability, not political freedom. The demoralization of young Arabs is understandable, given the failure of the Arab Spring to deliver on its promises. But one has to wonder whether some of that despair derives from the growing global consensus that democracy is losing its appeal. The Trump era. And then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Though you wouldn't know it from the writings of many liberal intellectuals and journalists, President Trump is very different from far-right and neo-fascist demagogues in some important respects. But of course, he's dismayingly similar in others. The differences are worth discussing first. Unlike Marine Le Pen, Norbert Hofer, Viktor Orban, and other illiberal politicians, Trump is not deeply immersed in nationalist ideology or any ideology. In no way whatsoever is Trump an intellectual. To say someone isn't an intellectual does not mean he is not intelligent. The question of Trump's intellect is an open one to all but his most committed followers and detractors, and to Trump himself, who constantly insists that he is a man of unimpeachable genius. He certainly possesses a formidable cunning that often catches his opponents off guard. But it is also clear that he knows very little about American political history, and that makes him a fascinating political creature. For instance, many of his favorite slogans, the silent majority, the forgotten man, America first, and even make America great again, have deep historical roots that he appears to have no appreciation for. He learned the phrase America first from a New York Times reporter who's trying to understand his political philosophy. America first has a complicated and storied pedigree in American politics, as it was the rallying cry for a broad coalition of non-interventionists who wanted to keep America out of World War II in Europe. Over time, it took on a particularly sinister connotation as the most vocal faction in it was objectively pro-German in the European conflict. In an interview with the Washington Post, Trump was informed that the phrase, the silent majority, was used by Richard Nixon in his 1972 campaign. It remains unclear whether anyone has explained to him that the forgotten man was FDR's slogan in his effort to appeal to the disaffected masses of the Great Depression. Even Make America Great Again is not original to him. It was used repeatedly by Ronald Reagan in his 1980 campaign, though he meant something very different. Trump's ideological commitments are similarly inchoate. Over the last 30 years, he has been consistent about only a handful of ideas. Protectionism, the wisdom of taking the oil from Middle Eastern countries we invaded, and some fairly vague platitudes about cutting back regulations. But beyond that, he's been all over the map on guns, immigration, abortion, taxes, healthcare, etc. Unlike traditional American conservatives, his lodestars have never been limited government, the Constitution, individual liberty, or, needless to say, traditional values. There is little reason to believe that he has anything more than a thumbless grasp of such concepts. Rather, his watchwords have always been winning and strength. His key promise to voters was that America will win again, and that, if elected, our leaders will no longer be weak. Winning solves a lot of problems, Trump said in an interview with the Washington Post. It should go without saying, but doesn't today, that winning and strength are entirely amoral values. Successful cheaters and murderers win. Good parents do not teach their children that the only thing that matters is winning. Nor do they insist that being strong is more important than being decent. A morally and philosophically serious person